KPFA. Today is International Women's Day. And yes, we women of the world get a whole day. I'm Tara Darabji kicking it with you. And I have Kali Ishel and Salima Hamirani in studio as well. It's noon, just reminding you all to move those clocks forward. I'm not sure why, but we all got to do it. Today, in honor of International Women's Day, we are doing 24 hours of special programming, and we're honored today at noon to be talking with you all about women in resistance and under occupation, acknowledging that here we are in Califatlan on occupied land, and we're going to spend the hour speaking with journalists and human rights activists about how women resist occupation in Palestine and Kashmir. And we'll also be looking at the gendered effects of occupation. We'll have all that and more. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after a short music break. شادية منصور والحطة هويتي من يوم ما خلقت سيدي والشعب مسؤوليتي لكن اتربيت بين الغرب وبين الشرب You're tuned into KPFA. I'm Tara Darabji, and kicking it with you, we have Salima in the house too, and we're looking at women under occupation. We're starting out today in Palestine. We'll be looking at both Palestine and Kashmir. Palestine was occupied first under the Ottoman Empire, then by the British, and presently by the Israelis. The Israeli government controls the movement of people and goods within Palestine. Today we'll be looking at both how women in Palestine and Kashmir keep the resistance movement alive right now. We're joined on the line by Samia Shoman. She's a Palestinian-American educator who is marking International Women's Day here in Oakland. Samia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you're out in the streets today. Tell us a little bit about how you're marking International Women's Day and why it's significant for you as a Palestinian American woman.
I am on my way, actually walking now to the march, and I'm very excited to join other both Palestinian and women of color and allies in marking this day. As I know, women back home in Palestine and, you know, Palestinian women across the United States continue to fight for the liberation of our country. And I think, you know, many people, when they think about resistance movements and the way it's been, you know, told throughout history, you see men on the front lines and don't really understand that women in Palestine are the backbone of resistance. And if it wasn't for them both being on the front lines of resistance movement, keeping their families together, while men are vastly imprisoned, and their, you know, their sons, and keeping things together, that this movement could not continue.
And I think some of what you're saying is very, I think it's very powerful that we do think of nation building or resistance movements to be sort of the purview of men's work. How have women been participating in the liberation movement in Palestine?
So I think, you know, women have been participating in the liberation movement in Palestine since the very beginning. You know, in many ways, in fighting, you know, on the front lines, you see women at the demonstrations, at the protests. They were part of organizing very first Intifada. You know, myself, I'm an educator, so I am a full-time high school teacher and a part-time university lecturer through educational spaces. I mean, women in Palestine are imprisoned oftentimes as, you know, bargaining chips to try to get information or to implicate, you know, men in our movement, oftentimes because they are actually on the front lines fighting for their rights. But then they have to put up with everything, right? Being kind of the center, you know, even though many people think Arab cultures are very patriarchal, I don't, you know, think that's an accurate description. I mean, at home, women are the center of families. They are the strength of families. They are the one that are passing on, you know, culture, identity, language, strength to, you know, their sons and their daughters. And so I think women have been very visible in many spaces in Palestine, whether that's, you know, through political movement, through educational movement, through the home, through passing on culture, through continue to embroider, you know, our beautiful, authentic Palestinian dresses, or make handcrafts, or teach their kids how to sing, or keeping our language alive, dancing debka. So I think there's so many spaces that women have been in and continue to be in. And I think even among Palestinian men, they know the value of women in the movement, and that's really important.
And Samia Shuman, how has it been for you growing up in the United States? How have those traditions been kept alive for you, and how do you continue to give them forward being here?
So I think one thing that's really important is growing up, I had the opportunity to travel every few years on vacation back home, and that's the way I think my parents really wanted to keep us connected. And in addition to my dad being really active in Palestinian communities in the United States, and so we kind of got that, you know, a little bit of that political activism in our blood through family. And then as I've grown up, pretty much since the year 2004, I have been back home every other year, sometimes multiple times a year. And, you know, I have two beautiful twins at home, a boy and a girl. And my daughter, I actually named her Falestine, which is Arabic for Palestine. And they have already been back home twice. We're going this summer. And it is really my way to keep my kids connected with who they are, where they're from, our culture, the language. And now they're at an age, you know, the summer when we go back home, they'll be about 4.5, where they can actually start to kind of understand what's happening. And I anticipate them asking a lot of questions about, you know, the wall, about the checkpoints, about the military soldiers. And I think where when I grew up, I did not necessarily have all that political understanding, and my mom kind of tried to safeguard us by giving us these general answers. I think for me, with my own kids and being an educator, I understand the importance to my children's identity of understanding that as a young age, of knowing that they're going to be in public schools here where the Palestinian narrative is not told, where the Arab narrative is not told, and if it is, it's through a negative lens. I mean, I've been in the public high schools teaching for 16 years, and so much is often done to shut that narrative out, or to twist it, or to make it look like, you know, our resistance is violent, and that we, I guess, kind of comes from a place not of self-determination. So I want to make sure, just not only my kids, but all kids that either come through my classroom or that my kids meet, that they are able to tell that story and to understand that story.
So I remember at one point I was at a conference, and there was a woman who was in sharing a room with me. And by the end of the conference, she sort of took me to the side and said, "Oh, I just wanted to let you know I'm Palestinian, but don't let anybody know." And it was very interesting because she was completely in the closet almost about who she was at this huge conference. So, I mean, I think it's very important and powerful that you've named your child Palestine, basically,
yeah.
And that you're very open about this, because there does seem to be a fear in the U.S. So
well,
on that, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So on that topic, how are women in America, in the U.S., talking about and participating in boycott and divest? But not only that, how are they participating in the liberation movement through art, through music, through being open about who they are?
Yeah, so I think, you know, part of that, just kind of going back to the story you just shared, is women out of, I mean, I was like that. I was very kind of in the closet growing up. I grew up in a kind of suburban, mostly white community, and nobody ever talks about Palestinians or being Arab, or is it, you know, and I'm pretty dark or tan, you know, per se. And so because I never heard of that, I was embarrassed or kind of in the closet. I see it with students who will say, who will be Palestinian, and say, "Well, I'm Jordanian." And then when I kind of push, they're like, "Well, I just say that because it's easier." And so I think today here, women are using, you know, arts and music. You see a ton, you know, of poets, of women at the conference yesterday and today in the march, speaking out on behalf of amazing women activists like Vesmia Oda, and working on, you know, that case and being connected wherever they are organizing. I mean, you know, the director in San Francisco, the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, Wadik Swani, is an amazing, you know, Palestinian woman. And so I think we're operating in a lot of different spaces. You know, I'm operating in an educational space. Other people are operating in an organizing your community space. But at the end of the day, we try to come together and unite around, you know, our cause, around our homeland, and make sure that, you know, among other issues that concern communities of color and women, especially on International Women's Day, that our voice is heard.
And what do you think are some of the most important international issues right now for the international community facing Palestinian women?
I think, you know, the lack of, in terms of, you know, Palestine specifically, the lack of movement, and whether that is, you know, checkpoints and women birthing at checkpoints and either losing their kids or facing either themselves or their kids extreme, like, physical and mental trauma because of that. I think, you know, being able to provide for their families in terms of trying to operate in an economy under occupation. I think, you know, breaking down of family units when Israeli occupation has been really violent, specifically in Gaza. I mean, people don't understand. It's like it is a mental, physical, psychological trauma that people are going through on a daily basis. And whether, you know, I see it here in America where I'm so privileged and blessed to have a great job and live in a great community and a great place and raise my kids. And I think, you know, sometimes this is so hard. I cannot imagine being one of many women, both in Palestine and across the world, that face multiple struggles because of, you know, colonizing powers, because of people with stronger militaries, because people don't respect their humanity like they should, trying to raise, you know, their children, bring their families up, and then do everything else, right? Whether it's work, be educated, kind of have a life for themselves. So I really respect that in all women across the world who are fighting for the liberation of their homelands, of their people, and raising, you know, strong families and being part of strong communities.
So often when we talk about liberation, we do think of it in terms of men's work, I guess I should say that again. You know, protests, fighting, that sort of thing. But I think what you've touched on is that when we look at the way that women participate in liberation movements, it brings in other ideas of what a revolution can look like. And you've mentioned mm-hmm. things like birthing at checkpoints, which is not something we think about. So right. What are the things that we learn about a revolution when we look at the way in which women participate?
I think that, you know, every day that women are on, you know, the forefront and you see them in pictures, whether it is holding up signs, throwing rocks, taking their kids, you know, to protest. I remember this past summer, there were several protests in San Francisco against, you know, what was happening in Gaza. And I saw families out there. People are taking their families. People are explaining to their kids, no matter how young they are. And I saw people with babies already kind of putting that, you know, into their blood and taking the time not to say, oh, it's too complicated, or I don't want my kids to face this, or I don't want them to know the reality of it. I mean, I think just the simple act, especially back home, of putting food on the table, right? Of, you know, having the strength to let your son or daughter walk to school, you know, or letting them outside of the house and hoping that, you know, they're going to return, because back home, you know, nothing is predictable. Like, you cannot predict. And we've seen that with some of the stories that have come out, you know, around what was happening this past summer, whether it was kidnappings or burning of kids or torture, you know, of kids who are Palestinian Americans. I think all of that is a way that you really see women, you know, at the forefront of these movements.
And you mentioned that you're a mother of twins. I'm actually a mother of twins too. Yeah, right. We could talk about that for hours, I'm sure. How old are yours?
So mine are 4 and a half. And you know, I mentioned my daughter's name is Palestine. My son's name is Jihad.
My daughters are Kali and Ishel. And, you know, I mean, it's a conversation I get in a lot about the levels of information that I communicate as a parent and bring them with. And I know, for example, like this last summer, we were out protesting at the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab, and people flyered up out there, and someone gave them a flyer of Palestinian children that had been killed in the war. And so there was actual, you know, pictures of bodies. And it was really interesting, like... you know, they definitely took those images and brought them and kept it. It was like a flyer that they wanted to talk about and share that this is happening to other children. And, you know, I've gotten a lot of different judgments and feedback from folks around bringing my children in that deeply to what's happening. And also, you know, I mean, I didn't give them the flyer, but we were at the protest and someone did, and they were open to that information. And so, you know, as a mother, how do you approach that and really sharing this information, and how do you decide what is the right amount of truth?
Right. I mean, it's really hard. I mean, my kids are really young and they ask you know, 4 and a half, they're at the age where their curiosity is really being piqued. And so I know back home will be a challenge, especially because I'm going to be by myself and my husband's not coming with me. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to be on my own for all these questions. But I think that they will notice. They will notice things that they didn't notice when we were 2 and a half and went back. There's particularly like the wall, the checkpoints, the soldiers. I mean, my kids are pretty intuitive and pick up on that thing, those kinds of things. But we have talked a lot about, you know, not everyone has a home like we do. Not everyone has toys like we do, or, you know, all this food and all gets to play. And so I think, you know, I will answer their, I think I will let my kids take the lead in terms of like posing the question, you know, when they pose the questions they have, giving them an honest answer. And I have struggled with that. You know, for example, we're going to the Gaza protest, and so they're chanting like everyone else, and I'll ask mama, okay, where's Gaza? What does that mean? Why is that? And so we'll go on the computer, and I try to, you know, not show them images that are too horrific, because I think sometimes they're young and that might scare them, but it's also a reality that I want them to understand. And I think for me, our trip this summer is so important, because next year will be the first year that my kids are actually going into public, you know, school for transitional kindergarten. Before that, I had them at a small private Muslim preschool. And so I think, you know, not being sheltered and being around other kids, like I want my kids to understand where they are from, and they're finally getting that. Like Felicine finally understands that that is her name and that is country, and she's named after the country. That took a long time just for that understanding to happen. And so I think that you have, you know, for every parent it's different, and you know, I think you let your kids take the lead in the questions they ask, and you try to answer them as honestly and openly, because I just know that had that happened for me, as much as we were involved, my dad would throw me up on the stage and be like, read this poem. You know, had he took the time and really explained to me what the poem was about, or explained, you know, kind of growing up what was on the news and what was happening in my country. I mean, we were on vacation during the first intifada. We'd always have to be home early. Mom, why do we have to be home early? Oh, that's just the way it is. She never took the time to, like, explain the politics. So it took me until, you know, well beyond my years in high school and college to really grasp everything. And I want my kids to get that on an early age, because I want them, A, to understand and to be confident. And I want my daughter to be that leader, you know, to continue the tradition and be a leader of the movement and on the front lines. And
well, Samia Shulman, thank you so much for joining us on KPFA.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go out there. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for taking time out of the march, too. I know you're on the streets, and for finding a good location and for joining us on the airwaves.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. We'll be back right after a short music break. I get a bitter taste in my mouth as the celebration around me increases. I know my old block gets smashed into pieces. And as the sky lights up from bonfiring, I know some people be running from gunfiring. Them be looking for cover until the enemy's done firing. Not every blast be non-violent. I said it's New Year's Eve. Don't know how we could be so naive. Raise the glass and cheer as we toast to the new year. You're tuned into KPFA. I'm Tara Darabji, kicking it here with Salima. It's International Women's Day, and we're talking with women, Kashmiri and Palestinian women, about the vast military occupation and women's roles in resistance. Kashmir is the most densely militarized land on Earth. An estimated 70,000 Kashmiris have died as a result of the Indian occupation. And today we are joined on the line by Athar Zia. She's a Kashmiri anthropologist and professor at the University of Northern Colorado. Athar Zia was also a former journalist for the BBC. Athar, thank you so much for joining us today on International Women's Day on KPFA.
Thank you so much, Tara, for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, and I know that you've been down with bronchitis, so I appreciate you using your voice to be in conversation with us. And I just wanted to start out with you and how you and your family and life has been affected by the Indian occupation in Kashmir.
Well, it's been quite a trip. So the first and foremost thing to understand about Indian occupation in Kashmir is that it's very, very invisibilized. At some point when I was growing up, at least till 1989, we did not have all of these political debates that were going on. They were not too public. So as I was growing up, it was, I like to call it a cosmetic piece, which was very superficial. And it just, one fine day, the dam burst, and that was 1989. And that's the time when everything came onto foreground and everyone started noticing that there was something that was terribly wrong, and a lid had been put onto it, and it had been pushed onto the back burner. And my own political consciousness kind of starts from that very day, from that day of first bomb blast, when it occurred in July 1988. And it started with similar things like that. And we were, as I was growing up, I would notice men and women sometimes getting together around these after-dinner conversations, talking about self-determination, which was called Rai Shumari or Mahaz Rai Shumari. And I would ask them, what is all of this? And many times I'd be like, you know, you'll get to know about this when you grow up. And that's how it kind of was held on till 1989. And after that, all of these debates just became, they were in our face. And survival in the early 90s and late 80s became the sole priority. And it was a dense militarization always, but it was always on the margins. But there are several sectors in the city which were densely marginalized, which were the cantonment areas or the garrison towns. So we were kind of like enmeshed into the system, but not really talking till 1989. Although politically we were a mess, but it was I would like to call it like it was well managed by the Indian government, and it was also well managed at the international level. And growing up in the 90s and trying to become politically conscious was also very difficult, because where do you get the education to know about your historical self, to know about who you were, when everything is clamped down, when you have military at every corner, when you are when you live under these draconian laws that can kill you and no one is held accountable. So it was very, very difficult, and it still continues.
And Arthur, I know that a lot of your work has really centered around women, gender, and militarization, and looking at how the Indian occupation has a deep effect on women in Kashmir. Why did you get started in that work?
Well, it was never a choice for me. I think growing up and trying to look at my own historical legacy, I found that I had none, because the way I had been educated in missionary schools or the education system that India had enforced on Kashmir, the way we were educated, we did not know much about Kashmir. And then suddenly when you start seeing people fall around you like nine pins, and you see your close friends either die or disappear, you start to question yourself. And then you also have these issues of rapes happening, and you have massacres happening, and there are crackdowns and crossfires, and you kind of start thinking about it. So it was never a question of whether I'll be, this was never an option. It was always out there that I needed to kind of question myself. Why was I in a certain kind of dark for a long time, and thinking that probably Kashmir was all Dal Lake, Kashmir was maybe tourism. Not that my family enforced that on me, but the cosmetic peace that had been enforced on Kashmir forced us, I think, till the 80s to kind of, there was this lull before the storm, and I was a part of that as well. And women, I think the very epitome of political consciousness kind of manifests for me when the first time I saw Parveena Ahangar, who is the co-founder of Association of Parents of the Disappeared Persons, when I saw her in a park protesting, and I was a journalist, and I kind of like was transfixed. And that was the moment when I thought that this is probably my life's calling. So it was never an option. It was always something that I felt like was a calling and was already out there. And the fact that Kashmiris have always been treated as this kind of a research lab by a lot of people who kind of converge around understanding conflict for good or bad reasons. I many times felt like a guinea pig. Many researchers, filmmakers, media persons, they would come in and ask us questions. And I was like, this is not all of these people asking us questions. There has to be some kind of an indigenous understanding. There has to be an intellectual movement, a scholarly movement that also kind of reclaims our own legacy and sees what's happening around us, and not only in a general way, but also in a gendered way, because I thought that was very important, because that was always a part of the movement.
So let's get right into the gender issue, and I guess this is a two-part question. The first part being, how does the occupation affect women particularly in a way that maybe is different from the way that it affects men? And the second part of that question is, how are women participating in the liberation movement?
So how does occupation impact women and men? I kind of see this, I don't really like this dichotomy to make the effects gendered, although we have different bodies which become vulnerable in different ways. So if men might be killed by bullets, a woman might be raped. So it's kind of like that kind of equivalence that we can draw at some point. So women and men, they have been equally impacted in different ways. But at the same time, when we think of, when we look at sexual violence, I think that is a major thing that has not been talked about a lot, that is coming to foreground now, because we have some very young, very active, very passionate women coming into public, and very rightly so, and talking about all of the sexual violence cases that have been going on, that have been recorded, that have been there in media but not really talked about, and for which no one has really been held accountable. So I think that one part is really an aspect that has hit women hard. And as recent as 2009, when two young girls were killed in Shopian after being raped by the Indian forces, and nothing has come out of it, and a lot of people have spoken for it, not just Kashmiris, but non-Kashmiris as well. And it goes back to 1991 with the mass rapes in Kanan Poshpura, where a woman, 70-year-old, and a 7-year-old kid, they were raped, and more than 40 women were raped. So it's kind of, that is something that needs to be taken cognizance of, and also mental health that has not been talked about, which kind of, this is all fallout of the intense militarization, this de facto occupation, which is so invisibilized. And the reason I use this word invisibilized is because when we talk of Kashmir, if you talk of Kashmir with people outside in this part of the world, and you sometimes might get these stares like, what is Kashmir? Where is Kashmir? What's happening? Is it a sweater or something? The idea is that no one really pays attention to what is happening, because it's been so well managed. It is so invisibilized. There is this politics of democracy going on, and then you have the draconian laws right beneath it. And then you also have this rhetoric of internalized dispute. And it kind of makes this entire situation murky, and there has to be a strategic way in which this can be described to people outside, and asking them to see how the state of exception has been created for the people there, and which hits men hard. Men have died. More than 70,000 people, women have died as well, and they have been raped, brutally raped, and sexual violence is also a reality for men. So the reason I'm kind of not really talking about the dichotomy here is, because here's an example. When women are protesting a disappearance, and we have more than 3,000 half-widows. Half-widows are the women whose husbands have been disappeared, and there are about 8,000 disappearances, half of whom were married men. So the question is that men were disappeared, and now the women are marginalized. They have lost breadwinners. They have lost people whom they loved. They have lost a way of life. So it's both men and women, but just because they bear different bodies, their vulnerabilities are different. But I see this really interconnected.
And Author Zia, we want to continue the conversation with you and hear more about Kashmiri women's role in resistance as well. And we'll get to that right after we have a short music break.
Thank you.
Are the sounds of Oakland's own Naima Shalhoub singing a song for Kashmir. You are tuned into KPFA. It's International Women's Day. I'm Tara here with Salima, and we're in conversation about women under occupation. We are joined on the line by Kashmiri anthropologist Author Zia, who's a professor at the University of North Colorado. And we are also bringing on Rama Kasej. She's a member of Arab Resource and Organizing Center. Welcome back, Author, and welcome, Rama.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you both for being here. And, you know, just as we continue this conversation forward, and looking at the strong resistance movements of Kashmiri and Palestinian women, and under these really intense, vast military occupations, one of the big things that I've seen sort of situated in the U.S. has been a media campaign that really shows both Kashmiri, Kashmiri women don't often get into the Western media in the U.S. that much, but specifically Palestinian women as being very victimized. And I'm interested to hear from both of you about how you see colonial feminism using emancipation to really promote the occupiers' agenda. And Rama, can you start us off with that?
Great. I actually want to first, happy International Women's Day to everyone out there and to both of you. I actually just want to take a minute of the time I have to discuss a case that we're currently fighting in the U.S. A lot of folks have probably heard about Asmiya Ouda, a 67-year-old Palestinian woman who was put on trial by the U.S. Department of Justice. She was persecuted in the Detroit federal court and found guilty by a jury of who were not her peers for unlawful procurement of nationalization. And it is important for us to raise this case right now, not because Rasmiya is only a, not because she's a Palestinian woman and a fighter in our community, but also a nationally recognized community organizer fighting for women rights across the board. So I just want to talk about her a little bit because her sentencing is coming up on Thursday, March 12th. Just a little background about Rasmiya. She, in 1969, was arrested along with 500 other Palestinians during an Israeli raid. And during her imprisonment for 45 days, she was raped and tortured at the hands of the Israeli army, which later pushed her into a confession about a bombing that took place 2 months prior to that arrest. Currently, and during her trial, the judge in her case would not allow the testimony of torture and rape into her case. In fact, he was quoted as saying, rape culture and quote unquote all that other stuff will not be welcomed into this court. So I just want to bring that case up. I want to urge folks to go to her website, justice4, Rasmia, R-A-S-M-E-A, to find out more about her case and how to support her case. In terms of women liberation and Palestinian women liberation under occupation, I want to say that Palestinian women have played a vital role in continuing the fight for liberation for all of Palestine and all the Palestinian people. And just like the sister said earlier, this dichotomy of women versus men under occupation, it's more nuanced than that. It's more complicated. And just focusing sometimes on feminism can oversimplify a very complicated or a complicated oppression process. I do want to say that, yes, just like the sister said, that the experiences of women and men are different. For example, in 2009, and there's a specific attack on Palestinian women. In 2009, the Israeli army were wearing T-shirts that had the lens of a gun pointed, this is on the T-shirt, the image, pointed to a pregnant Palestinian woman, and the slogan was, one shot, two killed. This was in 2009. So in addition, women experience it different in that the men who are arrested and killed in Palestine, these are their husbands, these are their sons, these are their financial assets and in their families. So for us, we as Palestinians, we see the liberation of women integral and pivotal to the liberation of all of our people.
So I think that the question that we really want to get to, though, is how, because you're both in two different countries which are predominantly Muslim, and the women fighting for liberation are Muslim women, but the way that Muslim women are often portrayed in the media in the West is that they are victims of these patriarchal societies, and that really the occupiers are liberating them from their mean men, basically. Right. So how is that image of Muslim women helped occupations remain in the countries, and how do you fight that?
Should I go first?
Yes.
So I have a couple of examples to give, which is a much more easier way of getting the point across. So the media usually is kind of like plays the colonial form of feminism or whatever you want to call it, which again is much more nuanced than just talking about colonial feminism. In 2009, one of the Indian politicians, she talked about Kashmiri women, and the way she, when she came to Kashmir, this Indian politician, she addressed Kashmiri women sisters as victims of the patriarchy in Kashmir. Mm. And there was this underlining nuance that they had suffered at the hands of men who had picked up arms. So there's always been this concerted effort to kind of undermine and also victimize or make the women of Kashmir as victims of their men. And you can see, if you go to Kashmir, you'll see a lot of non-governmental organizations, which are called NGOs there and non-profits here. So you'll see them operational, trying to get into these nuances and social issues, which are there and which should be worked for, but it's almost to undermine the larger resistance movement going on. And another example, which is really appalling, so all of us in Kashmir, outside Kashmir, and many people in the West are introduced to the Association of Parents for the Disappeared Persons and Parveena Ahangar, who is the chairperson for that movement and also one of the co-founders. She was actually nominated for the Indian of the Year in 2011 by CNN IBN, which is a media channel there. So just think about this. This is a Kashmiri woman who has co-founded an organization to look for her son who has been disappeared by the Indian Army. And she has been nominated for being and recognized as one of the architects and ambassadors for Brand India. And that was appalling. It was kind of claiming this Kashmiri womanhood that was resisting this occupation, that is denouncing this occupation, that is demanding justice. But they kind of like take it away, and they just portray it as if she is strengthening the Indian democracy by being who she is. And she did not take the award. She denounced the nomination. And one of the major things that they did while they were recognizing the award citation was that she has been relentlessly highlighting the issue of missing persons in Kashmir and forcing the government and rights group to acknowledge and act. The fact is, we Kashmiris do not call people who have been forcibly disappeared as missing. And that's one of the nuances that she also got out into the media and talked about it, that then these are not missing people. These are forcibly disappeared people. And they were kind of claiming and reclaiming her legacy and what she is doing as a Kashmiri woman for the resistance and trying to kind of like wrap it up into Brand India and present it to the rest of the world. And this nomination was a total farce, and it kind of like brought it home, like how we Kashmiri women and whatever we do is very vulnerable to the machinations of the state, and how they, all the things that women are doing as women, as through their gendered agency, can be reclaimed at any time. We just have to be very cognizant of what we do and say all the time, because it's out there very vulnerable for the media, for the state, and for all the other agencies that are working inside and outside Kashmir to undermine the movement.
Rama, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think in the case of Palestine, I think the mainstream or the dominant view of the men, you know, the you know, war, it's about saving the women of Palestine. I don't think that's the dominant view. I do think it happens, but I think that in the case of Palestine, both the Palestinian woman and the Palestinian man are both viewed as quote unquote terrorists. So I don't see that dichotomy particularly dominant in the mainstream media, although it does happen. It's not to say that it doesn't. It does happen. And we see that the fight for, you know, that we know there's definitely cases of internal or interpersonal oppression that exists within our communities, and that work needs to be done. But we also see it tied and integral to the institutional oppression, into the war, into the illegal occupation and the colonization of Palestine by Israel with the backing of the Western powers.
And Atar, what do you think has been women's most central roles in resistance in Kashmir?
Well, I have a very interesting status update that I wanted to share. This was written by a young journalist from Kashmir, and I found it on Facebook this morning. So it's not, there's this institutionalized kind of support that women have lent to the movement, and that is through some of the organizations that have been started, that are spearheaded by women and are part of the resistance group or the collective that works, that is a political wing of the resistance movement, and there are women there. But women have always been at the back of this movement, giving it support in whichever forms and ways that they can. And this status brought it really home to me this morning, and I thought it was kind of well rounded. And and even if you look at the Association of Parents of the Disappeared Persons, you kind of see, so there are two factions to it, and both are women-dominated. You kind of see how they are keeping, you know, today if you give a Google search and say resistance in Kashmir, women, or resistance in Kashmir disappeared, or human rights, the images that will, the first images to come up on your screen will be these women who are spearheading the movement for seeking human rights, just redressal, or seeking justice for these people who have been disappeared, and all other abuses. I mean, they're not just working for one thing. So the women are there, and it's not just the women looking for the disappeared, but women who are seeking and looking to redress the issues of prisoners the political prisoners who are spread all over India in different jails. So that is something very institutional, but there's also this very very invisible support that women have led, women have given, and that most of the time feminist scholarship kind of sees that as a very passive role. But again, it's very nuanced. It's not as if women are victims. Women have an agency as per their context, as per their culture. And I sometimes think the confrontational role that feminist scholarship thinks for a woman as agentive is not the only thing. But if you look into our cultures and see how women get agentive, they're very different, and you really have to be clued into the culture to kind of understand what that really is. So it's something like which my sister at the other end might kind of agree with, and anthropological scholarship has looked into it, and the idea of samud, which is this passive kind of resistance, but it's resistance nevertheless. So this brother of mine had written on Facebook that she unbolted the door when the Indian forces came raiding with men and children behind her. She squatted on roads for release of arrested relatives. She knocked police stations and jails to have a glimpse and feed hungry sons behind the bars. She restored electricity supply and replaced transformers by piling logs on roads. She took bullets while peeping and praying for the well-being of children caught in stone pelting. She made dying youth take last drops of water. She beat her chest to bring resolution. She bared breasts to feed martyred sons on the way to grave. Women of Kashmir. So I think it will take more than just thinking about institutional ways of lending support to understand what kind of support Kashmiri women have lent this movement and are continuing to give it.
Rama, do you have anything to add to that?
I think for the Palestinian case, I agree with the author on the phone. Sorry, what's her name again?
It's Athar Zia.
Athar,
good to meet you. Good to be on the phone with you. But I think to keep in mind that Israel is a settler colonial project, and that when we look at it through that perspective, and when we start from that perspective, it also gives us an analysis to understand in the ways in which reproductive rights in Palestine are impacted. Like I talked about the T-shirt before, you know, settler colonialism is based heavily on population, right? Mm-hmm. And getting rid of the indigenous population of Palestine. And as I mentioned, the T-shirt, the Israeli soldiers were explicit in 2009 of attacking women and pregnant women at that.
Is that something, I think that's a really interesting point, and I'm interested to hear if that same theme is also seen in Kashmir. And I know with the recent floodings, for example, there was these huge horrific floodings and just a complete lack of any response that it's, can you talk a little bit, respond to that in terms, Arthur, in terms of women being targeted around birthing and just, and I know that a lot of the infant deaths as well happening in the Kashmiri hospitals.
Well, it's been an issue in the early 90s and late 80s. These things did keep happening, and recently too, a lot of women wherever there was flooding, that they did get stranded, and there were problems with women during the if they had to go to a hospital for delivery. So that did happen, and what we also saw when the government totally it vanished. And then what we saw was that the people mobilized. They mobilized in small groups and then as a larger group, and we saw how they kind of resolved their problems, and they led rehabilitation efforts. They led rescue operations. So they did most of the things on their own. And then we also saw this hyper media attention that was paid to the Indian Army, which had led rescue operations, and that was something that added another dimension to that. That became another problem. And during flooding, when people are actually looking for survival, there were actually demonstrations against the Indian Army. So there are those constraints in place which always produce this gendered violence. But then again, we just don't want to look at it as gendered violence, and that kind of like tears men and women asunder. And I don't think that Western feminism does justice to thinking about the ways feminism manifests, the ways women's empowerment manifests, the way the word empowerment manifests in situations that are acutely cultural. We can just transpose ideas from here to there. So it becomes very important to see what's happening there with women and the way they're kind of leading their struggles and the way they seem fit, which is what I research when I look at the women in APDP. And they are actually, they use politics of mourning. And that's not recognized by a lot of people. It's kind of this social motherhood activism, and it's kind of this second-rate kind of activism for a lot of professional human rights scholarship, you know. Most of the political science scholarship, it's kind of like on the third or the fourth hierarchical level. So, but this becomes so important when you look into Kashmir and you look at the kind of responses or the resistance that they're having. So it's all gendered, and when you look at these women and you see how strong they have been all these years and the kind of politics they have, then it becomes very commendable. But again, you have to look very nuancedly to see what they do and not just kind of blanket them under feminism.
So we are almost running out of time. We have about a minute left. Rama, do you have any last words?
Yeah, I thank you again for having me on. I just want to urge everyone to look at Rasmia for Justice for Rasmia's website. I also want us to begin thinking about and developing an analysis on the ways in which Israel is a global repressive project that we need to tackle on wherever we are, wherever our locations are.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you both for being on the air with us today.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to KPFA. It's International Women's Day. This show will be archived at darabji.com. Want to give a special shout out to Vilma V for organizing, Dennis Bernstein for production support, to Salima for being here and co-hosting with me.